This is our second in a multi-part series on the Eish Kodesh, the Piasetzner Rebbe, the Rebbe of the Warsaw Ghetto. Last week, we did a little bit of a biographical sketch of the Rebbe, which I won't review here. You can see the recording from last week. I think you should have the link. And then we also took a look at the Rebbe's first couple of drashot. So just to situate us where we are historically, the Rebbe is in Warsaw. The Germans have just bombed Poland and Warsaw in particular. This is in September of 1939. And the Rebbe, who was already a rabbi and, you know, would be used to giving drashot sermons in shul, last week we saw the first two of those sermons. And the second of those sermons, the first was on Rosh Hashanah of that year, and the second was on Yom Kippur in September of 39. And just prior to Yom Kippur, a massive bombing had begun. And just after Yom Kippur, the Rebbe's son was struck by a bomb, and he himself rushed him to the hospital. While he was in the hospital, the Rebbe and his daughter-in-law and sister-in-law were there visiting. The Rebbe left briefly, and during that time, the hospital was bombed, and his daughter-in-law and sister-in-law were killed. And then a few days later, his son also died. And one thing that we noted during that time was that the Rebbe then was silent for about the next 5 or 6 weeks, meaning we have no record of his drashot during that time. The Rebbe also kept a personal journal, and he writes during that time, and that was how we closed last week, sort of very powerfully of his anguish during that time. And you see him struggling, as you would expect, in some ways sort of despairing, but also still declaring his faith in God and praying for salvation. Today, what we're going to do is we're going to take a look at the first time that the Rebbe then gives another drasha, another sermon, after his family had been killed. As Harriet Bernstein also noted last week, one could view that time in between as kind of his shloshim, that he was mourning during that time, not that someone can't give a sermon during that time in a technical way, but that is the most acute moment of mourning and anguish. And maybe that's why the Rebbe was silent during that time. One thing, though, which I think is particularly important to note is one of the parshas that the Rebbe does not speak on is the parsha of Vayera, which includes the binding of Isaac. And so I just want to begin a little bit by looking at some of the ways in which the binding of Isaac has been used by Jews throughout the ages, which can make this absence, I think, a little bit notable. And the Rebbe's first drasha that we have is in Chayei Sarah, which is the week following. So in the story of the binding of Isaac, one thing which we find which is interesting is that throughout history, Jews have used this as a way of, I'd say, processing or talking about martyrdom or loss. And Yosef Chaim Yerushalmi, the historian in his seminal work, Zachor, he writes that the Chronicles of the Crusades turn repeatedly to the image of Abraham ready to slaughter Isaac at Mount Moriah. So that the story of Isaac becomes a kind of paradigm that people who are going through an experience of their children being killed use that as a kind of story of a paradigm of inspiration. And in his phenomenal book, which I highly recommend, Aaron Kohler writes about the binding of Isaac. He shares one particular story of how Akedat Yitzchak, the binding of Isaac, was used during the Crusades. He writes, there was a young man named Reb Meshulam, son of Reb Isaac. He called out in a loud voice to those standing there and to Mrs. Tzipora, his wife. Listen to me, old and young. This son, who God gave to me and Tzipora, my wife, bore in her old age, whose name is Isaac, I will now offer him as a sacrifice, just as our father Abraham did with his son Isaac. Tzipora answered, my lord, wait a bit. Do not yet stretch out your hand against the lad whom I have raised and nourished, whom I bore in my old age. Slaughter me first, and let me not see the death of the child. But he answered and said, I will not wait even a second. The one who gave him to us should now take him back to his portion and give him a seat in the lap of our father Abraham. He bound his son, took the knife in his hand to slaughter his son, made the blessing of ritual slaughter, and slaughtered the lad. He then took his screaming wife. The two of them went outside together and were immediately killed by the Crusaders. So, of course, a haunting story. And there were conversations in rabbinic literature, about what to do if Jewish children were to be abducted and then converted, and whether it was permitted to kill them instead of them becoming Christian. But the interesting piece here, I mean, certainly this is a harrowing story to read, but is that we see that there is a story that's being told that finds a link between the current circumstances in that context and the story of Abraham at least being willing to slaughter Isaac. But the Rebbe himself doesn't attempt to find himself in the story of Abraham and the binding of Isaac, and in fact, remains silent on Parshat Vayera. And just to say, there, of course, is an asymmetry here, because in the story of the binding of Isaac, Isaac himself is saved at the end by the angel who intervenes. So here, there's a certain way in which if you're actually martyring your son, there's only so far that that story of Abraham and Isaac can take you. And yet, already in rabbinic literature, there was a kind of notion that not only was Abraham fully prepared to sacrifice Isaac, but in some kind of cosmic realm, he actually did. And we see this in citation from Rashi. In Vayikra and Leviticus, which has nothing directly to do with the binding of Isaac, we read, "I will remember, I, God, will remember my covenant with Jacob, and also my covenant with Isaac, and also my covenant with Abraham, I will remember." And Rashi says, "And why is the expression remembering not used with Isaac?" Right? It says, "I will remember Jacob." And then with Abraham, it says, "Abraham, I will remember." But the word remember is not mentioned with Isaac. And Rashi's answer, and he's quoting a Midrash, is because Isaac's ashes always appear before me, God, gathered up and placed upon the altar. There's a way in which God doesn't need to remember Isaac because there is some kind of divine altar in which Isaac's ashes remain there. So, of course, this doesn't make any sense because if you read the story in Genesis, Isaac is not killed, so there are no ashes of Isaac. But there seems to be some kind of parallel theological universe in which Isaac himself was actually killed. And the reason why I just want to mention this is I think in some ways this lurks in the background of the stories that we see in the Crusades and subsequent to that also, where people used the story of the binding of Isaac as actually a story that they could relate to when they themselves were in such desperate situations in which their children were killed or where they felt the need to actually kill them to save them from what they felt was a worse fate of being forcibly taken and converted. So again, given that there is that history of thinking of the story of Isaac as a kind of paradigm for Jews going through similar harrowing experiences, one might ask the question, why is it that the Rebbe does not himself give a drasha on Parshat Vayera? And actually, the first time he writes or speaks and then writes it down is Chaye Sarah. And I just want to keep that in the back of our minds as we begin to look at his what he says in Chaye Sarah, and we'll circle back to that question after we proceed. So Parshat Chaye Sarah, just to give us some background, the opening line there says, Sarah's lifetime, the span of her life, came to 127 years. Sarah died in Kiryat Arba, now Hebron, in the land of Canaan, and Abraham proceeded to mourn for Sarah and to bewail her. So right here, one might actually see why this opens the Rebbe's mouth. You have here the first mention of mourning in the Torah. And so perhaps that felt like that was an opportune time for the Rebbe himself, now something that he found more personally relatable at this moment. There are a number of Midrashim also that try and link up the death of Sarah with the binding of Isaac. The binding of Isaac is the story that concludes the previous parsha of Vayera. And now we see immediately after that, that Sarah dies. And so the rabbis saw a close link between these two, that perhaps it was actually causal. The story of the binding of Isaac, in some ways, actually causes Sarah's death. There are a number of different midrashim. We'll take a look here at source 7 on my version. Again, if you printed the sources yesterday, it's a little bit different. From Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer, which is a midrash most likely dated from the 8th or 9th century, though it purports to be earlier. Read the following. And when Abraham came from Mount Moriah, Samael, a kind of demonic angel, Samael's anger burned, for he saw that the desire of his heart to annul Abraham's offering had not succeeded. he was hoping to have Abraham not get any merit for his actions. What did he do? In his moment of spite, he went to Sarah and said, "Oh, Sarah, have you not heard what has happened in the world?" Sarah said to him, "No." He said to her, "Your old husband took the child Isaac and offered him up as a burnt offering. And the boy was crying and wailing because he cannot save himself." Immediately, she began to cry and wail. She cried three cries corresponding to the three tikkiot, and three wailings corresponding to the three yivavot. These are just different sort of sounds of potentially a shofar. Her soul flew from her, and she died. So always important when we're looking at a midrash to not just think about purely on its own terms as a made-up story, but also what is the kind of gap or what is present or absent in the Torah itself that the Midrash comes to fill in. And in this case, it seems clear that the Midrash and other similar Midrashim are motivated by the close proximity of the binding of Isaac and then Sarah's death. And we see here the story that it tells is basically one which is saying that Sarah died because of the binding of Isaac. Now, in this case, she thinks that Isaac was actually slaughtered. But I think as we think of the Rebbe, his moment where his child and other family members had been killed, the fact that he's going to quote this, I think very much demonstrates that he is finding his own expression in a sense that one could almost die by virtue of the pain and suffering that they are experiencing because of the death of people around them. One other background story that we have here, the Rebbe will quote, the Gemara in Brachot actually has a long sequence of statements and stories that have to do with suffering and theodicy, sort of justifying why it is that good people can suffer. And one of those stories, we read the following or statements, and that is the statement of Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish. So Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish said, the word covenant is used with regard to salt, and the word covenant is used with regard to afflictions. It's not uncommon in rabbinic literature to find it's almost like a hyperlink between the use of a word in one context and another, and then to try and find a lesson that can be learned through that linking. He continues, the word covenant is used with regard to salt, as it is written, the salt of the covenant with your God should not be excluded from your meal offering. With all your sacrifices, you must offer salt. So there needs to be salt as part of the sacrificial rites. And the word covenant is used with regard to afflictions, as it is written, these are the words of the covenant. The context there in Devarim and Deuteronomy has to do with the klalot, the curses that God will force upon the Israelites if they don't obey the words of the Torah. And so that is a form of affliction. And so for Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish, there's this use of the word covenant both in the sacrificial moment and with regard to suffering. And what's the lesson that he learns from that? Just as in the covenant mentioned with regard to salt, the salt sweetens the taste of the meat and renders it edible. So too, in the covenant mentioned with regard to suffering, the suffering cleanses a person's transgressions, purifying him for a more sublime existence. Just the translation here, just so you know, this is taken from Sepharia, which is the translation of the Steinsaltz Gemara. So the bolded is the more literal, and then the non-bolded is where they kind of fill in, often based off of Rashi, based on Steinsaltz's own interpretation. So those last few words are not in the text itself. But the fundamental point here seems to be that salt sweetens meat, and suffering somehow also cleanses a person's transgressions, and somehow makes their existence, therefore, better. So this is one notion of theodicy, of trying to justify suffering that someone can experience. And the idea here is that suffering is part of the a kind of purification process. So this is the background. And now we can see what the Rebbe himself says. Just for those who are joining, these drashot were given orally. These sermons were given orally, most likely in Yiddish, on Shabbat. I think typically at Sudash Lishit in the evening. And then the Rebbe or scribe would write them down, and then they would further be edited, which we'll actually see in a little more detail in a moment. The Rebbe writes, it is written in the holy work Maor Shemesh, another Hasidic work, at the beginning of Parsha Vayera, in the name of the holy rabbi, the man of God, our teacher and master, Menachem Mendel of Rimonov. Regarding the Talmudic passage, a covenant is made with salt, and a covenant is made with afflictions. Just as salt makes meat palatable, so too afflictions purify the individual of sin. Just as one cannot derive pleasure from meat that has been excessively salted, rather only if it was properly salted, so too afflictions should be meted out only in such measure that they can be tolerated, and even with an admixture of mercy. So first, I mean, the Rebbe here is quoting someone else, but we see already, I think, two significant pieces. One is that in the midst of all the suffering that is taking place, he is simultaneously affirming the role that suffering can have in one's spiritual life. And we saw something similar last week. And at the same time, he's very powerfully declaring that that needs to have limits. So there's something quite subversive happening here. If you just read the Gemara on its own, it seems to be justifying suffering. And almost the message to someone who's going through suffering would be, your suffering, well, just as salt makes meat sweet, so too your suffering in a certain way will make your spiritual life enhanced. And in this subversive way, while taking that analogy just one step further, the Rebbe here, again quoting someone else, is basically saying, just as it's possible to oversalt meat, it is also possible to, as it were, oversalt a person of suffering to the extent where it actually no longer has that beneficial spiritual effect. The Rebbe then continues quoting Rashi. Rashi explains that the death of Sarah was juxtaposed to the binding of Isaac, because with the news that her son was being bound and was about to be sacrificed, her soul burst forth from her and she died. That is to say, Moses, our teacher, the faithful shepherd, juxtaposed the death of Sarah to the binding of Isaac in order to advocate for us, indicating what results from excessive afflictions. Heaven forbid her soul burst forth. Right, so what he's trying to continue along this line and basically saying, starting with the subversion of the Gemara, that it's possible that you are salted too much, you have too much suffering. We have a case study from the Torah in which Sarah dies, and as a result of too much emotional affliction. And I think what's very nice about what he's saying here, this particular move, is those midrashim that we looked at before that try and link up the death of Sarah with the binding of Isaac, essentially what the Rebbe here is saying is that actually teaches, it's a kind of cry out to God to say, see what happens when there's too much suffering. So now I think this adds greater meaning to the midrash. I mean, the way the Rebbe is couching it is by the close proximity in the Torah itself, but it's really the Midrashim who make that causal connection. And the Rebbe is now teaching a broader lesson to that. And one thing which I believe I mentioned last week, but is also significant, often a role of a Rebbe is to advocate for his flock. That was part of the structure of the Hasidic world. There's kind of this authority and power granted to the Rebbe, or specifically the tzaddik, a righteous person. And that power means that they can intervene on behalf of the people. And I think part of that power in my mind is not just whether that's cosmically true or not, but actually from the perspective of the people who are members of the community, that sense that here is this person who is so righteous and they are spending their time and their energy advocating for us. There's something which I think can be very powerful and consoling in that way. And so as he is giving this drasha, I almost imagine his community listening to him and basically saying that the Torah itself is constructed in such a way that Sarah's own death is kind of a cry, a beseeching to God to not afflict the people too much. The Rebbe then continues. Furthermore, this was the case with the tremendously righteous Sarah, that she couldn't bear this, who was as blameless at the age of 100 as at 20 years old. That's from the Midrash of how the verse is broken down. She was 120 and 7, that she was just as pure at age 100 as she was at 20. And all of her years were equally good. Yet despite this, she was unable to withstand such horrible afflictions. How much more so does this apply to us? Therefore, may God have mercy upon all of us, Israel, and save us speedily, both spiritually and physically, with revealed acts of loving kindness. So we see here also from the Rebbe, I think, a way where he is affirming this notion that suffering can have a spiritual place. And at the same time, to the people, even at this earlier stage of the war, and of course, it's important to always keep in mind, we know the full history. They don't know what's ultimately going to become. So kind of at each stage, it's just the worst thing that they've ever seen. But for them, even at this somewhat early stage, this, I think, is giving affirmation or validation to people who are basically having the experience of, we're prepared to accept some notion that suffering can have a spiritual value. And at the same time, this is too much. And I think what the Rebbe here is saying is, you're not only you're not heretical for having that experience, but Sarah, who herself was such a righteous person, she herself was basically in the same situation as you. So the more so should you feel that it is okay and appropriate to have those spiritual thoughts. This drasha actually extends a little bit longer. And we'll get into this slightly more detail in a second. But one thing which is very interesting about the Eish Kodesh, as I mentioned before, that the Rebbe would give a drasha and then write it down, but he actually then would often come back and edit what he had written. Sometimes that was just in a crossing something out or adding a word, but sometimes he would actually add in whole paragraphs. And we see that actually here, just before the end where he signs off, he adds the following. He says, it may also be explained that our mother, Sarah, herself, who took the episode of the Akedah so deeply, of the binding of Isaac, so deeply to heart that her soul departed, did so for the sake of Israel, to demonstrate before God how it is impossible for Israel to endure excessive suffering. He seems to be now making the statement even more clear here than what was said before. For even one who through God's compassion remains alive after suffering, nevertheless, parts of his strength, mind, and spirit are broken and lost to him. What difference is there between one who is killed entirely and one who is half killed? I think that line is very powerful. Until now, this seems to be a sermon that's about ultimately Sarah dies and what he's saying here, I think, which is very powerful, is that there are spiritual lessons that apply here even to one who is essentially just broken of mind and spirit, that there is physical death, and then there's a kind of spiritual almost death, which is essentially the same. And the fact that the Rebbe wrote this later, and we don't know exactly when, might also suggest that as time went on, as things got even worse, there became a shift in how the Rebbe was thinking, and that he was experiencing the life of the living dead as almost being akin to those who had been entirely killed. He continues, this is what resolves the verse, the years of the life of Sarah. For at first glance, Sarah appears to have erred relative to the rest of her years, since she could have lived had she not taken the matter of the Akedah so deeply. Right? He's basically saying, one might argue that Sarah should have suffered through the experience of having been witness in some form or another to the Akedah, but potentially in allowing herself to be overwhelmed to the point of death, potentially that itself was a mistake on her part. But he continues, but since she acted for the sake of Israel, the verse hints the years of the life of Sarah, that is the years after the 127, or I think of 127, were equally for the good, for even through them, she did not sin. I think the additional piece here, which might be significant, is I think what the Rebbe is basically saying is that the fact that Sarah died and leaves her, I think there are two ways here, either as an advocate to God for the unbearable nature of her suffering, or as being a kind of model for future Jews, that there is in fact a limit for suffering and you can take solace in your inability to actually tolerate them, that somehow that actually turns Sarah's own death into a kind of righteous act. And I think this is particularly intriguing to me because, as I shared at the outset, it's possible that the Rebbe would have tried to find inspiration in Abraham, in Abraham's willingness to sacrifice his son for the sake of God. And I think that probably would have been the more expected path that he would have taken. And I think it's quite interesting that the Rebbe does not seem to actually identify with Abraham, or does not try to hold Abraham up as the paradigm for his flock to be inspired by, but actually says something very different, which is that Sarah herself, who's incapable of tolerating the potential sacrifice of Isaac, that itself is actually where he himself finds voice. And I think the model that he is holding up for his flock. And so I think that there is something which is very powerful about this, something that just conveys to you a sense of a certain kind of sensitivity that the Rebbe has to the degree of suffering that his people are going through, and not trying to, at least in this moment, the Rebbe, nothing's linear. He shares different ideas at different times, but at least in this moment where he is finding it easier to use Sarah as the paradigm than to use Abraham as the paradigm. I want to take some questions and comments in a moment. Just before we do that, I wanted to give you a sense of, because we see here how the Rebbe amends this drasha as time goes on. So I wanted to give you a sense of what the Rebbe's actual texts look like, what the manuscripts look like. And so what we see here, and this comes from significant work that was done by Rabbi Dani Reiser in Israel, really combed through these manuscripts and has the most recent edition of the Eish Kodesh, which tries to mark exactly how the Rebbe marked his own text. But just to show you what's happening here, let's see if I can zoom in. And if I can find it, the handwriting's quite hard to read. Here, the Rebbe seems to mark right over here, if you can see my cursor. This seemed to be the end of the original drasha. And then there's a marking here. And then if you go up, this is where the Rebbe then at some point later, and you can see it looks different handwriting slightly, which means it's possible. Actually, this one was written by a scribe, and this was the Rebbe's own handwriting. As someone who has awful handwriting, I took some solace in not being able to read this. But we see here, there's a whole paragraph for which the Rebbe then ultimately amended. So I think that in initial publications of the Eish Kodesh, that would have just been incorporated into the main text. Whereas in this most recent edition from Dani Reiser, he puts a kind of note where this appears in his transcription. So you can tell what's written when. That book is actually available online, both the photos, the facsimiles, and his own writing in, I think it's through the National Library, but if someone is interested in that and wants to send me an email, I would be happy to send you that link. They're freely available online in PDF form. But just to discuss, and we're sort of zooming out slightly, and then I do want to take your comments on the drasha itself. This is how Rabbi Reiser, the significance of the work that he did on the construction of the Midrash, this is how he explains it. He says, the sermons were produced sequentially, one proof succeeding another. Further evidence of this appears in the letter Rabbi Shapira appended to the manuscript with instructions for the reader and publisher, including a system he had devised for proofreading his text. I believe that careful investigation of the manuscript's archaeology, its layers and emendations over time, calls our attention to a human phenomenon worthy of discussion. Many of the marginal notes were actually written late in 1942. Rabbi Shapira was already aware by late 1941 that Polish Jewry was facing an unprecedented catastrophe from which it might never recover. So one that's important to see, that what does it mean for those notes that we see to actually be written a couple of years later? What does that add to the text rather than just incorporating it as if it were one document written at one time? Reiser continues, by the time these late notes were added to the manuscript in 1942, in fact, the mass transports from the ghetto to the death camps had already begun. Rabbi Shapira must have known that there was very little chance that he, his manuscript, or any of his immediate followers would survive. Under these circumstances, his commitment to painstaking, multi-layered, and minute revision of his already finished text should not be taken for granted. Rabbi Shapira knew that he was going to die and had already lost all his family. And how did he occupy himself? With correcting and editing his sermons. Rabbi Shapiro stopped preaching just before the Great Action, which began on July 22nd of 1942. Major parts of his proofreading were carried out after the ghetto emptied. It is clear that at that point, Rabbi Shapiro was not working on his Torah in order to provide hope or self-respect or for the sake of suffering for the other or even for the effective strategies that would allow his followers and the cosmos itself to resist collapse, since there was no longer an audience or an other or followers, and the cosmos did collapse. It seems to me that his writing under these circumstances expresses the value of Torah Lishma in its most extreme form as a ritual in its own right. Torah Lishma is the notion that we study Torah purely for its own sake. It's not instrumental for something else, not necessarily about teaching, not about how ultimately might affect our lives, that the act of sitting and studying Torah has its own value. And so the reason why I wanted to share this was in the construction of what the Rebbe has, there's a lot that I think we can glean, which we'll see in a second from Shaul Magid, of a shift that could occur over time. But also, I think what Rabbi Reiser here is explaining is that this gives us a bit of insight into, in the final days of the Rebbe, what was he occupying himself? He's occupying himself with the study of Torah, that sort of even in this moment of hell, and even where there was no longer people to really care for, and even when he had no family and there was no hope of survival, the very act of studying Torah was something that he continued to find meaningful, and he wanted to refine the ideas that he had previously written. Just to give you a sense of what may have been, I even wouldn't say sustaining the Rebbe, but occupying him and what he felt meaningful, even in that most horrific of times. One other perspective, though, also about the emendation, we'll see a little more of this in a future class. Umagid, who's a professor at Harvard, he writes, "I'm specifically interested in his final sermon in the summer of 1942, and more specifically, in a brief addendum he added in November of 42 to a previous sermon, which to my mind breaks through something Shapira never quite acknowledged before, that what he and his community are experiencing, what the Jews are experiencing, has never been experienced before." This admission, apparently a final edit to his writings after he had put his pen to rest, likely a rereading of an earlier sermon after the Great Deportation, is more than a mere depressing flourish, although certainly that too. I think it breaks faith in a covenantal God and sets the stage for what would become post-Holocaust theology a few decades later. So again, we'll see that in more detail in a subsequent class. But the main thing that I wanted to explain here is that the marginal notes that the Rebbe writes both can convey a little bit, according to Donnie Reiser, of sort of his own mentality that in this moment he is trying to just engage in Torah for its own sake. And I think for Shaul Magid, give us potentially a window, an insight into how the Rebbe may have shifted over time. And we could see that from various sermons, but specifically if the final few months where he wasn't writing any more sermons, but he was still editing what he'd written before, the fact that we can see sort of what he wrote in an earlier form and then how he edited it can actually give us a sense of perhaps how the Rebbe and his theology have shifted. So we'll get more into that in a detail, but I did want to kind of introduce us to this concept, given that in Parshat Chayei Sarah, we do see a substantial paragraph, which is added only later. So I'm going to pause here. And if we have some questions.
Thank you. I put this in the chat because I wasn't here last week and I don't know what your minhag is, but let me see what I wrote. I said earlier, perhaps one who is spiritually dead is so deeply afflicted that they die physically. And I followed that with, and that the ones who survived the camps or fled and were hidden, but mostly in the camps, for example, Viktor Frankl, were able to hang on spiritually and thus survived physically.
Yeah. And so you're saying that you think there's a way that the spiritual sustains itself, a person spiritually actually allows them to physically sustain? Is that what you're saying? I think you might not be able to unmute yourself.
Yes, that is what I'm saying.
Right. Yeah, I think one thing which is very interesting, this is why this is also significant that this was amended later, is that, right, I think what you're pointing out and highlighting is something which is very significant, which is this is a very powerful statement, which, you know, Viktor Frankl was able to sustain himself and maybe for the Rebbe, he was able to for some time, and at some point he might be almost broken at this point and is not able to kind of fully hang on spiritually. I mean, he is, right? So he did have this work that he was working on, being a Viktor Frankl, right? He very much felt that if you had meaning, a purpose in the camp, or just in suffering in general, then that can allow you to sustain. And so I think the Rebbe's work himself that also allows him, but also towards the end of his time, it might be that the Rebbe was basically overwhelmed. And that's why I think the fact this is written later is significant, that he may have experienced one thing earlier on in the war, and then after a couple of years in the ghetto, may have been faced a more dramatic theological situation. And certainly for Shaul Magid, as he alludes to there, and again, we'll get into this more in a subsequent class, there's actually a greater shift in his theology.
I'm wondering how this might relate to the fact that Abraham and Isaac, after the Akedah, never spoke again, and whether that is, in a sense, a living death as well.
Mm. Are you saying that it's a reflection of a living death, or that meaning that they were unable to speak to each other because of what had happened, and that sort of splitting became a living death, or that the experience of the Akedah was a living death, and that is alluded to by the fact that they don't talk to each other?
Yes. Your father and son never speaking again is such an alienation that I consider it something of a death.
Right. Yeah. No, I think that's a great point. Again, it's later in a slightly different context, so the Rebbe seems to say something similar here, but certainly I think that is very valid.
There's on PBS, at least through Boston, there's a series on, you know, it's post-Holocaust remembrance on Elie Wiesel called Soul on Fire. And it is magnificent, and there is so much documentation that he shares about his experience in the camps, when his father dies, and the years after, the difference between one who is killed entirely and one is half killed is incredibly portrayed. I would really recommend it to anyone if you are struck by this.
And what's that called again?
It's called Soul on Fire, and it's through the American Masters series.
Okay, thank you.
On PBS.
Yeah, thank you. Michal?
In your first class, I was struck by, or confused perhaps, by whether the rabbi did or did not overtly link the notion of suffering and its cause to the divine, to God. It seemed to me the linkage was implied perhaps, but not overt. And I'm struck by that in the text here. And Shaul Magid then clarifies that for me in the sense, this seems to me there may be implicit in this text as the suffering grows, a kind of internal struggle in the rabbi as to whether God could actually cause this and still be God.
Yeah, so. I think that is very well said there. And that for Magid, and we'll see this either next week or the one after, I think, in that theological shift. And that is what Magid means by sort of a post-Holocaust theology, which is very much, you know, what you're saying is, you know, could that be the case and God still be God? Meaning the God of, and that's a post-Holocaust theology, is that's actually a very different God than the belief that people would have had before of a God who potentially could have actually caused this. So you're pointing us to something which is very key, and we'll go into that in more detail either next week or the week after.
This is more of a biographical question. So if you covered it last week or you don't have time, please tell me. But I know that many prominent rabbis were rescued, and many obviously weren't. But I'm just curious how that played out for him. Clearly, he wasn't one of them to be rescued. But I'm just curious, like, colleagues. Yeah, go ahead. Thanks.
Yeah, I don't know about how I'm seeing colleagues specifically. I do know that he He had the opportunity to be rescued and chose to stay back. He encouraged people to be rescued, as opposed, I think, to the Satmar Rebbe, who did not encourage people to flee. He did, but he himself did not want to abandon his flock.
Just one thing, and then I'll ask my question. I know he came out with a statement, the Rebbe, that the real Rebbe does not abandon his flock, which is obviously his reaction to others who did. But I have read this before, so I know his new theology, which I don't want to bring up now, but did he, as we see, when he amended these notes, did the people who heard the original sermon, if they were aware of the changes? Were they aware of this change?
My guess would be no. The only thing that I think could be comparable might be, if they heard these ideas develop, or specifically if, they lived to see another round for that same parsha, and then, if there was a shift. Yeah. But to my knowledge, I don't think these manuscripts were then subsequently shared. Of course, we don't know what he also then said.
So they wouldn't necessarily have known his change.
Right. But also, I think what Donnie Reiser is arguing is that many of the changes occurred after he had stopped preaching anyway. Right. So most people were not around at that time.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I could just note that some people might think it was a terrific miracle that these manuscripts in the steel boxes were dug up from the earth after the war, found and dug up, and they were intact and could be read. And it reminded me of something I studied recently on the Parsha a couple weeks ago, that the Netziv in the 18th century offered a view that at the burning bush, the fact of one lesson in the burning bush not being consumed by the inner fire, it could be that endurance is a miracle, just as much as winning a triumphant battle and creating something great, just the endurance. So I'm more looking for something like Yitz Greenberg might say, that the Lord may be stepping back a lot and leaving it to us.
Sure. Yeah. Well, thank you for that. That's always a very beautiful message. And then also with Yitz Greenberg, that really gets into the post-Holocaust theology. Right. And as we'll see when we get to that in the subsequent session, both Shaul Magid and other scholars, Aaron Lieb Smokler, have tried to argue that the Rebbe was kind of the first proto-post-Holocaust theologian. We can see some of those ideas, and we'll get into a little bit more of what post-Holocaust theology might mean. Okay, I have about 10 minutes left, so I think we'll move through. The next section is a bit shorter. I just wanted to share this also from the Eish Kodesh. In the next week, Parshat Toldot. One thing that I think I mentioned last week was important to note: there are very few examples the Rebbe actually explicitly mentioned something that's happening in that particular setting. So we can know by historical work and linking it with the dates of the sermons. But he himself often gives messages which are very timely without actually mentioning specific events. This one is a bit of an exception. And he reads the following. He starts by quoting from a verse from Isaiah, which says, "And then they will come, those who are lost in the land of Assyria, and those who are dispersed in the land of Egypt." There are two different types of people here who are lost. He says there are two distinct categories, the lost and the dispersed. The dispersed refers to one who is displaced to a distant locale, yet remains distinct and recognizable. This is in contradistinction to the lost. This person is lost and is neither distinct nor recognizable. For when the hardships are presently so compounded that they even cut off the beards of Jews, and just before this happened, there was sort of a mass rounding up of Jewish men and cutting off their beards, so compounded that they even cut off the beards of Jews, which make them outwardly unrecognizable. And due to the unimaginable persecution and unbearable afflictions, they are no longer recognizable internally. Such a person loses himself. He seeks to recognize himself. How did he feel a year ago on the Sabbath or on a weekday prior to prayers? or during prayers, etc. Now he is trampled and crushed, such that he no longer senses if he is a Jew or not, or a human being or not, or an animal, which has no capacity to feel. This is the nature of one who is lost, yet they will come, those who are lost. So first, he's so speaking to the people. I mean, there's the outward piece of how you appear, and you can imagine that someone who's used to looking at themselves in the mirror and seeing a beard, and all of a sudden that's gone, how that might affect a bit of their sense of self. But then he goes even further. He's basically saying, right, the whole religious spiritual life that we had, the cadence of the week, what Shabbat felt like, what I'm sure the holidays felt like, what prayers themselves felt like, has been so dramatically transformed to the extent that it's hard for people to even remember what those experiences were like. They're losing their senses of self, kind of in the most deep, visceral experience. They don't even feel like they are Jewish or even that they are human beings, right? And of course, this is part of what the Nazis were trying to do, which was to completely dehumanize the Jews. And he is giving expression to that experience, right? But then he continues. Talmud teaches that one who has lost something seeks after what was lost. When it was lost, it was no longer perceptible or recognizable, and therefore its owner seeks to find it, to pick it up and bring it home. And is it not God who is the master of us who are lost? I think there's a powerful notion there. He's saying you are feeling like you have lost your sense of self, but sort of your who is your owner, as it were, that is God. And so we are almost lost in our sense of self to God. But God has to seek us out, not only at a time when the Israelite is visible and recognizable, but also with respect to those who are lost, unseen and unrecognized. He will return again and give again. The owner of what has been lost will return to us, find us, and give us all goodness. Restore us to him, blessed be he, and redeem us with redemption and ransom our bodies and our souls with abundant mercy and good salvation. May the owner of the lost return to find us. And again, this is still early on in the war, and we see, I think, especially in contrast to the previous week, and especially with the emendation that he made later on, the Rebbe is simultaneously, or sort of in one drasha, able to highlight and focus more on the sense of the suffering being unbearable and pleading with God to say that it's too much. And then we see here something which is very beautiful, still very much speaking from within the experience that people have of feeling like they are lost. They are lost to themselves, but also they are lost to God. And then in this moment, like still relatively early on, affirming a certain kind of faith that, and in a beautiful way, that just as the owner of a lost object seeks out that object, so too, you know, we are lost to God. God is our master. God will seek us out. And he is expressing this statement of both prayer, but I think also of hope for that kind of salvation to come. And, you know, of course, one of the challenges of this, we'll see as the Rebbe develops his own theology, is what happens when that salvation never does come. But here, at least, he's trying to, I think, a couple of things. One is he is making an affirmation of faith. I think he is also very much trying to give hope to his people that we feel like we are lost, but God is seeking us out. And to some extent, I think that hope is something that people very much needed, and itself could be something that helped to sustain those as they were in the midst of these horrors. We have just about 2 or 3 minutes, but if anyone has any questions or comments here, I'm glad to take them, and then we'll close for today.
Yeah, sorry, I couldn't find my little hand raise button.
Okay.
I want to say thank you for bringing this material to us. It's very difficult to encounter. I don't mean to speak for everyone, but I'm sure that that we encounter it with the weight that it has. And it's incredibly powerful, and thank you for being an effective conveyor of it.
Appreciate that.
I've been studying this a little with my colleague Lisa, who you heard from a little bit before, and we were reading a different one of his drashot where he refers to the term misirat nefesh quite a lot. And it's a big topic to ask right before class, so I'm happy to table this if maybe we could talk about it in the future or if it becomes relevant. But I think the question I have for you is, what is his counsel to his Hasidim about about how they are to bear this and what exactly their role is in this theodicy situation, and specifically how he intends that term. What are they to do and how are they to cope?
Right. Yeah, not something I can get into offhand in just a few minutes, but it is there are a couple of drush out that use that term, Mesirat Nefesh, or kind of self-sacrifice, that I was thinking about including. So thank you for that, and I'll take note of that.
Yes, also so much gratitude to you. Just a quick question. I missed at the beginning, you were saying, what part of Toldot is he drashing on here? I missed that connection.
Yeah, that itself, and this is one of the challenges of trying to teach this, a lot of Hasidic writing can be a little bit intricate and convoluted. So that in this particular case, I think there's sort of a prelude having to do with Isaac's blessing of Yaakov, which is a little bit complex and intricate. And to kind of do that whole thing would have taken a lot of time. And I don't know if it would have helped for these purposes. But it has to do with the opening of the blessing of that Yitzchak gives to Yaakov. I'm not trying to hide anything. Also, it's just in terms of the nature of it, I just thought, you know, we would spend too much time and it wouldn't actually help us with this particular theological piece.